I'm discussing a little bit Maxwell's equations, and I want to study Maxwell's equations to discuss a bunch of things into one. And we'll go into the lab section later, but I want to just make sure we clarify a few points. The first point is it's going to be so free versus constrained evolution, say. How do we know we can do either one? The other one is assessment of hyperbolicity in more than 1D. And the third, and this will kind of come in together, is how we can modify the equations to our advantage, depending on what is it that we want. We mentioned some of it later on the latter part of yesterday, but I want to give a particular example, a few examples together. So let's say, and we're assuming we're not even doing numeric at the moment. We just want to ask the first question, so it's completely at the analytical value. So the issue of discretization, that comes afterward. We want to know at least how robust how is our system of equations and the approach we're taking to iterate them. So let me first consider this problem. The first question is, can we solve the constraints initially, iterate with these equations, even when we're doing a perfect job, i.e. we're doing it analytically, will the solution we obtain at a later time be a solution of Maxwell's equations that has satisfied this and this too? Okay, there is an obvious, you probably have seen this before, but there is an obvious answer to that, which is we're perfectly fine, thanks to, say, Bianchi identities. So we know Maxwell's equations, in particular if we write it in terms of the Faraday tensor, satisfy that, and we can use that to see that the constraints will be satisfied. At the more kind of pedestrian level, we could do the following. So let me, for simplicity, define these two functions. So the divergence of E constraint and divergence of B constraint. And let's say, well, what happens if we are give initial data satisfying or not this to some given level of tolerance? What happens if we evolve that configuration forward to the future? What are the constraints doing? Because if we find out that the constraints are diverging from whatever initial value that we had, for instance, zero, if they're satisfying, then we couldn't take a free evolution. Somehow we would have to be building at every single step the condition that the constraints have to be satisfied. Okay, so of course this is a straightforward thing to assess. We take the time derivative of this, which will be the time derivative of divergence of E. Then I can switch the order of the derivatives. I can now use the evolution of E to replace this in terms of the curl. And of course what we find is that it's zero. So the message that is telling us is that whatever initial violation of the constraints we have, or if we are satisfying it exactly at the beginning, at the onset, the evolving those fields that someone gave us, or we construct E and B here, that satisfy the constraints to some tolerance at some tolerance level, once we pick those iterate forward in time, and we ask, are we getting a solution of Maxwell's equations here? Of course we're getting a solution to the evolution equations, because that's what we use to go from here to there in the free evolution picture. But if we now evaluate the constraints, this tells us that at least analytically we'll be preserved. Preserved in the sense that if they were satisfied initially, they will be satisfied later. If they are satisfied to some small error initially, they will have the same small error later. And that's as good as we can ask. Of course, we have to worry about what we're doing at the boundaries. If we're at the boundaries, we're introducing severe violations. Of course, we're going to have some contamination, but let's for a moment not worry about boundaries. And the same thing, I mean, one reason I'm using Maxwell's equation as well is it's a proxy for Einstein's equations. Einstein's equation satisfies precisely the same, thanks to Bianchi identities. And you'll see next week how we can assess this, and not only this, we're going to take a further step, which I'll now motivate by modifying the equations, these Maxwell's equations, which we're going to change this behavior. We're going to see that not only can we get that the constraints will be preserved as far as its initial violation, but we can modify Maxwell's equations of the constraint system, of the constraint manifold, to make sure that we are actually coming back. So what I mean is, again, of all the possible solutions of DTE curl, well, the equations we have there, of all these possible solutions, there is a subset that satisfies the constraints. This subset satisfies this plus these two. Let's say if we give an initial data that is some epsilon away from the surface, we're not solving Maxwell's equations, we're solving a different theory. It's a different theory that has these four evolution equations and some behavior for the constraints. Of the constraint surface, we're going to see that we can modify the equation such that if we start with such a thing, we're going to drive it back and bring it back to the constraint manifold. And we want to do that, of course, eventually numerically, because numerically we would never be able to satisfy these equations exactly. We're always going to start with some small violation, and we want to understand the question of where these small violations can completely take us away from the constraint surface, in which case we're not solving the problem we want to. Luckily, at this, on the mathematical level, we know that's true, and we want to exploit these mathematical observations to our advantage. So let me just imagine that I change the equations. And this is related to what we mentioned yesterday, as to the ideal MHD equations not being is hyperbolic enough from our point of view, and that we could modify it. So this is one particular strategy that we can follow. Suppose I change the equations, and I'm going to say, these are my new equations. And you see why I'm doing this in this particular way in just a second, and it's going to become totally obvious. So what have we done? We have added, at the analytical level, for the solutions of Maxwell's equations, zero. But at the practical level, we have added something that if we are off the constraint surface, we'll have a life on its own, and we want to know what is going to be the impact of this onto the system. So first, let me do exactly what we just did before. I defined the constraints in exactly the same way, but let us now ask the question, what's going to happen in this system with the constraint? How does this evolution preserve or not the constraints that we have in the theory? So C is, again, this would be the same as the divergence of E dot. And of course, we can do the same kind of calculations for B. B and B are totally dual. And so this will be the divergence of the curl of B. I'm following this line plus this kappa, this some factor, L, the divergence of E. When I act on with the divergence on each term, this one gives me a zero. This will give me two terms, the divergence of L, one that gets the divergence of L, and one that gets the derivative of the divergence of E. So this is going to be kappa divergence of L times the divergence of E plus kappa L I di the divergence of E. And now, let me just rename this with the constraints name. So this is kappa, the divergence of L times C plus some kappa Li di C. And now we have an equation of motions for the constraint that's completely, say, unaware, at least explicitly, of what E and B are doing. We just know that if we evolve the equations with these new modified equations of motions, the equation that we get for the time derivative of the constraint has these two terms, while before we had the zero. So let us just discuss a little bit what these two terms are. First, let me think about this one. So this one is some number times the advective derivative, the derivative along the vector L, which we have yet to specify. We have never said anything about L. It's just a vector we think we're carrying around, of CE. Right, so if I look at this one, let me ignore that one for a second. This looks very much like C comma T equal kappa C derived along some direction. Right, along the direction of L. So if you now ask the question, what is C gonna do? Again, we're ignoring this for a second. We're saying, oh, this is an advection equation. So whatever initial violation I may have, now it's gonna move. Before, if I had an initial violation of C, it would stay there in place. The reason we want to know that that is the case is that, say you have a little violation initially, and you imagine you have a black hole that is sitting there. The violations typically, when you solve the initial value problem, will be much larger than far out. So you have a violation there, which is constantly being resourced by the fact the black hole are there. So this could potentially have the possibility of just that error grow and grow and grow as we go along, because it's always at the same place. While if that error that we produce at any given time begins to drift away, it doesn't have the chance of just continuously refeed onto the solution we're obtaining. And typically we'll see that simulations will be better behaved if any error can be drift away, and in particular we can do it in such a way that as it gets to the boundary, it goes out and it doesn't continuously have a bad influence on the solution. So that's a good property that this one gives us. Now it gives us the ability to advect away any error. But furthermore, we have this other term, the first term, which notice, okay, we have the divergence of L. L is something we can give by hand at any given point. And so now we have, what this is adding is a possibility of exponentially decay or have force the constraints to decay away. Because now this term will be something like mine plus kappa some number. This number is the divergence of L times C. If this kappa is negative, now we have an advection, an exponentially decaying possibility for C. You guys see what we have been able to achieve by thanks to doing that? All right, so now we change the equations, and what we have managed to do is exactly what I said. If we are exactly at the constraint manifold, we haven't added anything, and our theory hasn't changed. We have changed the theory. This is no longer Maxwell's equation. This is something else. It's your theory, if you want. But it's a theory such that if you start with a small violation of the constraints initially, it will flow onto Maxwell's equation. And because generically you're always going to be making some error in the description of your initial data, even when you know it analytically, once you represent it numerically, it's only going to be an approximation to round off. It's good to know that you can do this possible. I mean, you can play with some freedom in your theory to fix things. And we did it in two ways. One, to make sure that the constraints will be advected away, but beyond that, and more importantly, we're gonna dump the violations away as we move forward into the future. Okay, so now we have to, once we put this, we also have to see what price have we paid in order to do this. So all this looks good, but we want to understand what are the new propagation speeds. We know that, and we're gonna do both things at the same time, but let me just remind you, we expect the Maxwell's equations to provide propagation modes that propagate the speed of light, right? So that's, let's see that. And so that will give me an excuse to discuss this hyperbolicity in more than one dimension that we have never kind of looked into it in detail. So now when we have a system that has more than one dimension, so let me just think of our fiducial problem. Let me imagine that we have A, or let me just call it mx dx of u plus my dy of u plus mz dz of u. So how do we assess hyperbolicity here? Because now we have three matrices. Before, we always look at one matrix. So at the very bottom, there is a very kind of rigorous way of doing this, but let me just kind of give you some at least necessary conditions that you need to have in order for a system to be fine. One is that each individual matrix has to be diagonalizable. If anyone fails to be diagonalizable, we throw it away. Or we come and said, what are freedom we have in the theory? Do we have any constraints that we can come and fix that problem? Then if you happen to have the possibility or finding that there is a complete set of eigenvectors that simultaneously diagonalizes each of the three matrix, That's the best possible case. That's called strictly hyperbolic, and we're in extremely good shape. If not, at the very least, you like to see that each individual one is invertible. And in principle, there is some techniques called a symmetrizer where you can say that there is in the background the possibility of always diagonalizing the matrix at once. But we're not going to get to that. We're going to just think at the bottom, at the simplest level, that each one should be diagonalizable. Now, we also discussed the principal part of the system, and we said, okay, when we look at the principal part of the system, we ignore everything that is undifferentiated. But now we have things that have propagations or differentiations along all three directions. The way we treat that is we are going to think that we are picking one direction in particular, which would be x, y, z, or any combination of them. And once we pick that direction, any derivative that is orthogonal to that direction, we're going to think or we're going to assume that it's already known. Right? For instance, so if I pick the x direction, when we look at the structure of the system we have, anything that has derivatives along y and z, we're going to ignore. We're going to think of it as belonging to the lower order terms of the system, just as we did when we studied this system, say, and we only stay with that. So in this case, if we had u, y here, we also just take that one. Typically, then, we just pick a particular direction. For instance, that direction could be L. And so the matrix that we will have to be looking at is a contraction of MI and LI, which combines all of them. And then we will study that matrix that we have and see if that one has a complete set of eigenvectors. If the eigenvectors do not depend on the direction that we have chosen, then we're home free. This is the best possible case. So now let me illustrate with essentially this problem that also, of course, accounts for that one automatically and see what we have gotten when we change our theory, which is now this one. So our equations of motion are DTE. Well, sorry, now let me just write it again, are these ones. Let's pick the direction x to do the calculation to find what the matrix is. So what we do is we expand this all out, and then we look at every term that has derivative with respect to x. Those are the ones we're going to look as far as, we're going to watch as far as our matrix is concerned. And anything else we're going to discard. We're going to ignore because it doesn't belong to the principal part of the system. So I'll just give you the answer. Let me just write the matrix M sub x. So we're going to write a vector in this order, bx, by, bz, ex, ey, ez. There is a big matrix here. And of course, that vector differentiated along x. So let's just look at the different pieces that we have. And I'll be able to then make connections with things we have said. So let's say we're looking at this equation. When I look at this one, I see that, say, the derivative of t of bx, so I'm looking at the first row here with respect to time, we have no contribution here because when we're taking the bx component of the curl, we know it doesn't have derivatives along x. So we don't have anything coming from here. But we're going to have a derivative of ex along x, right? So then I write what the matrix is going to be. And this is going to be, let me order this in the opposite way. Ex, ey, ez, bx, by, bz. So I'm same, what did I do here? Yeah, so I'm looking at this one. So now let's do it that one. So we're going to have a one sitting along one for bx. So I have a bx here, by, bz. And this one is k1 lx. So I did this the other way around. I want a b here, and this an e. Sorry about that. The t, the e, I want the e dot, right? Because when I did it here, I wanted the time derivative of ce is the divergence of e dot, and it replaced with this one, and I had e. So I had a typo here. So again, we have no derivative coming from here, and we have a KL1 coming from here, LX coming from here, right? And then I have zeros everywhere else. So now I'm going to look at the next terms, let's say EY. Okay, this one will not contribute. I have a DY, EY, and a DZ, EZ, but we're picking the direction X. So this one is no longer contributing. I'm going to have from here a derivative of BZ with respect to X. So I need to go to Y, to where the derivative with where BZ will be. And we see from here we're going to have a minus 1, right? And everything else is 0. Sorry. And I have one more term here. When I take the derivative of EY, this one I have DY, EY, but that one, of course, doesn't contribute. So that's a 0. And so on. Here I'm going to have a 1, 0, 0, 0, 0. Now let me just, for the sake of the argument, concentrate on the last one, BZ, T. So BZ, T, okay, I have to pick it up from here. And what I see is that I'm going to pick up a DX of EY. So this DX of EY. I'm looking at this one, so I don't have a, I have zero. EY is sitting in this is EX. EY is sitting in the second one, and this is going to be a minus 1. And so on. And now what we, sorry, it's not a, it's a minus 1. This is 2 and 8, yes. And now it's what we begin to see. Remember when I said that if the matrix is symmetric, it's already a good sign, because that tells us that we're likely going to be able to invert it. And the good thing is that you see this one and that one, which is the conjugate of the, if I look at the conjugate matrix, this one maps onto that one. That makes it symmetric. And then the next one will give me a 1 due to that one, and so on. So we end up with a matrix that has this structure. We have minus 1. This would have a 1. So we have 0, 0, 1 in here. And for this one, I'm going to have a kx lx, or k, sorry, the constant kappa lx. And everything is 0. So when we look at the characteristics of that system, we find out that we have modes that have propagation speeds equal plus minus 1. Plus this kappa that we introduce, and some other modes that have 0. So the little price we have to pay was now that we have changed slightly the propagation speed, so we have, I'm sorry, another ones that have plus minus 1. So we have some modes that now can propagate faster than light. We could choose kappa less than 1, or sufficiently small that we'll have this close to the speed of light. But what we have done, in a sense, is add the constraints. And these constraints can carry their own speed, which was this kappa. And that modifies the characteristic structure of the system. So it's, that's, of course, not a problem. We said we have a different theory that when we take the limit that the constraints are satisfied, this is not adding anything new. And we're converging back to Maxwell's equations. But this was an option. And I'll tell you the second option. This is the option that is going to be very closely associated to what we do in Maxwell's equations, in Einstein's equations, and you'll see that next week. Let me now tell you about one of the options that we said we could do in the ideal MHD case, which is to add extra fields to the system. So let me think that if we change the system, we're going to have our variables E, B, and now, completely out of the blue, I'm going to add two more fields, phi and phi. The reason I'm adding these two fields, these are called penal penalty fields, this will tell us indirectly how the constraints are being satisfied. We're going to have to deal with more variables than what we started with, but you'll see what we get. The equations of motions are going to be now the following. T, T So I have another constant. This is how I define. Again, notice that if phi and psi are both identically equal to zero, we're back at Maxwell's equations. So these are fields that are, if they are identically zero, we're good. These are the equations we have. Of course, we still have the constraint to satisfy, div E and div B equal to zero. So we give initial data that satisfies these conditions, and we give initial data, say, for phi and psi and phi initially to zero. So we initially start at Maxwell, but we are going to say, well, suppose the numerical simulation as it goes develops small errors. How is that new theory going to behave? The first thing is notice, let's analyze how the constraints behave when we evolve with this system. And for the sake of just now taking the error constraint, I'm going to just do it with respect to the divergence of B. So I take the dot of this one. That's going to be the divergence of B dot. I have to replace my new equations for B dot. This is the divergence of the curl of B minus di of phi. And this is equal to minus the Laplacian of phi. Right, I use that the divergence of the curl is zero, and then the next term is minus the Laplacian of phi. So now I see that the constraint has a different behavior. The time derivative of the constraint knows about how phi is behaving. So we now need to say, well, how is phi behaving? So let me take this equation, and I'm going to take a dot of this equation. Sorry, of this equation, and take a dot of this equation. So phi comma tt is minus divergence of bt, right, minus sigma dot sigma phi comma t. Okay, we know how the divergence of B dot is going to behaving is equal to minus the Laplacian phi, so this is equal to the Laplacian phi minus sigma dot phi comma t. And now I can put these things together, so this is the box of phi. Same flat spacetime. And this, the general solution of this equation, subject to these initial conditions, is what? I'm going to guess. We have the wave equation with a damping term, which is this one, is precisely phi equal to zero. So this says is as you're evolving, if you're beginning to develop numerical errors that will give you something that begins to violate this constraint, it will feed up in such a way that will add a driving term. So if you have vectorially, again, this is a constraint surface. If you start here and you begin to drift away from it, this one will bring you back in. And again, that's a pretty useful thing to have because it could be, your boundary conditions could be approximate. They may be leaking some constraint violations, and this system will react. So it's an active system that wants to bring you back to Maxwell's equations. Furthermore, you can write down what the matrix eigenvalue, so the principal matrix of this system is. Okay, you have to be careful because now we have more fields. We have E, X, E, Y, E, Z. Let me stick here phi, B, X, B, Y, B, Z. Let me stick the little phi. So this matrix has a banded structure, so it has, well, before we had essentially zero without the k, the kappas that we had. Now, for instance, if I look at what is the time derivative of Ex, we recall that this one does not have any derivative with respect to x, so this one doesn't contribute anything. But now we have a derivative of x of phi, so we're going to have a 1 here, and so on. So I'm not going to write this, but if you find out what the structure, this is a very simple 8x8 matrix, what the characteristics of this system are, they're all eigenvalues are either plus or minus 1. So everything propagated at the speed of light, and you have a complete set of eigenvectors. So we paid a huge price in some sense. We had to add 2 more fields, but having done so, we have a system that is very, very clean, and it has very desirable properties. Of course, when we added this, the fact that we have some ones was because we had a 1 in sitting here. If you actually want a different number, p in here and here, you're going to see that the equation, the sum characteristics now will have a value p, if that's something you want to do. But generically, with 1, it's perfectly good. And so we now have all constraints move, all constraints satisfy, are being dumped, and the characteristics of the system are as good as it can be. This is the technique that is used in this other approach that I told you yesterday. There was this 8th wave that you modify the right-hand side such that you had a complete set of eigenvectors, but some people would complain that now you were not dealing with fully conservation laws, at least when in the Newtonian case. Well, you could say if that's a criticism, you can take this other approach where you add 1 field, because there we had only 1 constraint. Deduce what is the right equation that satisfies the damping, and it couples in the right way, and then everything is home free. Notice also indirectly here, that we're also trying to respect the symmetry. When I said I'm going to say I didn't have this term, in addition to changing the way the variables will propagate, say I said, well, let me imagine that there is another field, phi, that will have this. Now I see that phi will be exponentially decaying from here, and I have div e. Then I could imagine that this might be good enough to achieve what we have, what we want to have. But the problem is that then I would say that phi is coupled to the gradient of e, because the gradient of e appears in the right-hand side. But if I don't see e coupled to the gradient of phi, I begin to be suspicious because now the symmetry is broken. Remember I said, well, if we see a symmetry in the matrix, we're probably in the best possible case. If we didn't have this term, there would be an asymmetry between e that wouldn't know anything about the gradients of phi, while phi would know what the gradients of e. So that's always, as I said, a red flag. And if you were to analyze the structure of the system without these terms, you see the system is not strongly hyperbolic. It's just weakly hyperbolic. Of course, at this point, you say, well, this is a lot of, it seems like a black magic. You just started with 1 system, Maxwell's equations, and I had that freedom to do it one way or this other way. Which one I should try? Well, hopefully, the initial system that you had is as good as it can be, and you try it and it works, and then you never have to worry about these things. But if things begin to be not behave in the right way, and you do the analysis, and you see that perhaps constraints are just staying there, or are not propagating back to the surface, the constraint surface, you might try either one. And actually, there are successful stories in both of these approaches. I just wanted to present you that you have plenty of freedom in any theory that has constraints, because you can always modify things in this way. Because if you don't have constraints, okay, you get what you get, and there is nothing else you can do, right? If we're dealing with our initial equation, okay, we cannot change the physics of that equation. That's all we have to then live with it. But when you have constraints, you have more freedom, and that's the reason that when we think about Maxwell's equations, we think of things being propagating at the speed of light. And that's true. What we know is that we can change Maxwell's equations by, no one tells us what the right time to iterate things is. So we can change a coordinate transformation. You can write Maxwell's equations with respect to a boosted coordinate frame. So you'll see that you're still going to have in the boosted frame, some things propagate at the speed of light, but some other things will propagate at different speed. And these are seen as, are regarded as constraint modes. The constraints can propagate at any speed. And so that's what comes into this problem. And if you do the full analysis of that the original Maxwell system, you're going to see that some modes propagate at the speed of light, but some other modes propagate at zero. And these are the constraints that are not propagating at all. And we see that when we did that evolution, dt, the time derivative of c is equal to zero. So that's something that doesn't propagate. So any questions? Okay, you're going to see this in a much more impressive way for Einstein's equations, where one actively uses Bianchi identities to realize that if what you can change the equations in a particular way, you're going to have a good propagation of the constraints. So rather than solving, RAB, say, equal to zero for the vacuum case, you're going to change things here. And what you're going to have, you're going to add things that know about Bianchi identities, have derivatives so far. No, sorry, not derivatives, derivatives of the constraints and the constraints. And when you see, ask how will the constraints behave in this new theory, they will be exponentially decaying away. And it was this difference that essentially in 2005 made the difference between not being able to evolve the binary black hole problem to actually get it done. And Franz will tell you about that. So let me just discuss a few of the things of the RMPL code so that you understand what's in there. The unfortunate thing is that when you do that, RMPL does not completely or necessarily give you a recipe for everything, and you're going to have to put a lot from your end. Oh, let's see, does this work? Let's see. Oh, yeah. What happened with the stick? Someone took the stick. Anyway. Okay, so when you untar the distribution or the package we gave you, this is the RMPL that you have. Oops. Sure. Okay, as before, we need to introduce a bunch of parameters, so it's something for the memory, how big the box is going to be. And now we have many more pieces of physics that we want to describe, because we're not giving it necessarily a smooth distribution for the fluid. We're going to give something on one side, something on the other side. And what we're solving here is just the Berger's equations for a Riemann problem. So we're going to imagine that there is constant values of the functions up to some value of the coordinate space, and then something else completely at the other side. So we're defining things like this values at the left and the right of the variable q. And this particular MPL is actually doing a bunch of things at one. It's going to do the finite differences and the flux, the high resolution shock capturing methods at the same time, so you can compare all of them. So as a result, we're going to define several grid functions that to keep the different values. The rest are some parameters. OK, this is what we're saying. We're going to need some arrays for the function q that we're iterating. We're iterating q dot plus q squared divided by 2 comma x equal to 0. So we're going to, there are several that are defined. One is non-conservative, center, second derivative, second order accurate, et cetera. We know that at least in the case, we're going to use high resolution shock capturing methods. We're going to need to define these fluxes. Remember, we're going to have to reconstruct the fluxes at the interface of the cells. So we have this grid structure when we are trying to understand how to update this point and get this one. We imagine that it's surrounded by the little cell, and we use the information to the left and to the right of the cell to predict what the value of the fluxes would be here. But because there could be discontinuities, we're going to predict the value of the flux to the left and to the right, and then use that in this raw solver that we defined. So we define another grid function, which is this FF, which is there so as to keep track of what the fluxes are. And this is a residual so that we can, at the end of the day, evaluate where the solution we're obtaining is correct. Remember, we define this residual as someone at the point where someone has handed you a solution, you can say, well, I don't know what you did to find a solution, but I can do a blind test, just feed that solution into the numerical, a numerical approach, discretization to the equation, and see how good the satisfaction is or isn't. Of course, we define the Kranz-Nicholson update just as we have done. Then where we're doing upwinding is for this equation, which we know propagate things from right to left. One particular method that works is to say, I'm going to take the time derivative using these two. I'm going to take the space derivative just using these two. Notice I'm not using information to the left. I'm only using information from where the fluid is coming from or when the signal is coming from. And this is perfectly stable. It's funny in a way, because if we were to do this R problem, or this problem in this way, you take the time derivative using these two points, and you take the space derivative using those two points, you think you're doing a better job, but in reality, if you do this, it's going to be unstable. If you do this, it is stable. And we can, if you want, we can then look at in detail why it's one stable or not. But this is the standard upwind method. And it's upwind or downwind where you're, this probably would be downwind. It's just a matter of convention where you're using information to the right or to the left. And you use information to the right or the left by noting how these modes are supposed to be traveling. So if you try it from right to left, you use information to the right. If you use the opposite, it's going to be unstable. So if you are in the mode of trying, you can then just iterate that same equation, but define the upwind in the opposite direction, and you're going to see it's going to blow up in your face very, very quickly. And this is called the first FTCS method. It's first order in time, because the time derivative that we're doing is should be in there, everything evaluated. But we're going to center in space here. And because we're centering in the old level, and we're never updating, we're not doing any iteration whatsoever, we use these two and that information to obtain the value of the function here, and we keep going. This is completely unstable, and this is stable. So the first part is just very much like what you're used to. But now we need to begin to put the right ingredients to be able to hook up with this fancier way of interacting things as dictated by the high-resolution shape capturing method. But as I said, we're going to have these three different options as well, just using the standard finite differences that we've been talking so far. This one is the upwind. This is an upwind. This is with the velocity or iterating. So here we do q times the derivative of q. In this one, we're doing the derivative of q squared divided by 2. So the two forms of the two ways of writing the system, we can write it this way. Or like this. And depending on how we treat one or the other one, we're going to have different solutions. Because again, the truncation error that this one will provide is going to be different from the truncation error that this one will provide. And the way the truncation error combines will then have a mind of its own, and it's going to impact the solution. And I showed you last week movies that you obtained, but here you can just go and play on your own. So the first one is doing the second option, because we have q times the derivative of q. The second one is doing the second option, because it's just saying the derivative of 1/2 q squared, comma x, both upwind. And the third one is doing the 1/2 q squared, but taking the derivative more accurately, the second order derivative. Have a question? Ask them. This is what we're trying to do.
Why is it not an equation? Like, why is it? Like, you have this CN equal to mu of Q and C, B of Q. Why is it not equal to zero?
Oh, so the residual will say, if you can put it equal to zero, or not. If you don't put it, it's going to assume it's equal to zero. So you could put here equal to zero. Sorry, That's a good question. So, okay, those are the standard approaches with the finite differences, but we want to do better. We want to do this this stepper that knows about the high-resolution shock capturing method. As a result, we're going to have to provide from the outside, because RNPL does the Crank-Nicolson, doesn't do anything else. So we can come and modify the Crank-Nicolson in a complicated manner, or we can say, well, Crank-Nicolson, or RNPL, you handle the memory, you handle the output, let me handle everything else as far as the guts of the iteration. So we're going to say, well, we're going to have other updates, and we're going to, I need headers, well, I need spaces for this new variable, these new routines that I'm going to introduce, that will, I want you to, or when RNPL, to pass me the value of the state of the system at the new level, at the old level, and everything else, so that with that, I can reconstruct things. So I'm going to walk you through the different files that one has to modify. And then we do. But notice that here, let's see, we're asking an auto-update of QNC, QC, Q2C, but we're not asking it to update Q, because the Q is going to be what we're going to be updating from our own routines. So that's that one. So let me just discuss each one by one, and then we'll see how we combine them. So the first one is this calc A. This is just a calculation of the matrix. Remember, we have to evaluate the matrix, the flux matrix, which is the derivative of the flux with respect to our variables. This is DFDQ. So of course, the matrix for these Berger's equations will be very simple. It's just a 1x1 matrix. And so this one is simply defining so RNPL provides, say, the hook for this one, and we just have to say, okay, this is how we're going to define our matrix, and our matrix is defined here, A equal Q. There is a lot of things. The person that writes this was extremely careful and wanted to make sure that at every single step, when you write big codes, typically you're going to be introducing lots of bugs, unless you check essentially every meaningful calculation one by one. And so this is what it's then. L-trace is of something, it's a logical variable that is turned on or off if you want to debug. So here, if it is false, the code will not do anything, but if I turn it into true, it says, okay, first, I'm going to print the value of Q. That has to be given to me by the main driver, the main code. I'm going to print it. I'm defining A, and then I'm going to print it as well. So you can always ask and see every piece of the code that is doing anything meaningful that check if something is correct. Of course, if you're like me, I rarely do this, and I try. There are debuggers that help you in debugging, but when I ask Matt Chopwick, who is the one that wrote this example, I said, what do you use for a debugger? He said, I never use a debugger because I never write a buggy code. And after seeing his codes, I totally can see that he probably does write always without any bugs, because he's much more careful than I am. So this eta is just the eigenvalue. So in the notes or in the code, we called it lambda. So eta is lambda. So we know the eigenvector. The eigenvector, which we call R in our notes, here is just a 1. So we just define that. And again, it has a very similar structure for the rest. So let me just go. I'm going to get to the interesting part soon. We need to know what the flux is, because we're going to evaluate things as the flux. We need it to be a routine or a function, because remember, we're going to reconstruct, say, using the information to the left, what the value of the function of the variables would be there, the same thing with the right. With combining, and we'd evaluate the flux there. So we're going to have to pass some given value of Q, and then that this step will tell us what the value of F of the flux is there. This is the ROI solver. Remember what the ROI solver tells us, that the flux, reconstructed flux at the interface, what we're going to use to take the spatial derivatives, needs to know what the value of the flux is to the right of the interface, to the left of the interface, and we added a little bit of corrections to account for the jump, which needs to know what the absolute value of the eigenvalue is, what the jump is, this is what we're calling here omega, and what the eigenvector is, right? So this is very simply what this routine does. And we're going to keep it, we keep calling it whenever we need to. Okay, so now this is more of the guts. Okay, this is what it's saying. It's going to calculate the fluxes at that interface. So for that, we need to do a few. We need to take a few steps. We need to reconstruct. We need to call the flux, and we need to evaluate things. And so here is where that is being done. Notice one thing: there is a do loop there. Notice that it doesn't start at 1, nor it doesn't end at nx. It starts at ng. Ng is a it's a given number, which is small, and I'll tell you what it is in a second. So in our grid, no, it's over there. So this is the outer boundary, this is our whole grid. This is the inner boundary. The outer boundary, we have our number of points. One difference between this linearly degenerate equations, that like Einstein's equations, to these truly nonlinear problems, is a solution. We know in Einstein's equations or Maxwell's equations, when we're close to the boundary, we can ask what modes propagate to the right and what modes propagate to the left, and they're independent of what the curvature is at any given point, right? Because locally, if you want, everything can be described by a flat space-time metric, and then we know that we should get things moving to the right, things moving to the left at the speed of light, or things are not moving, but those are weak constraint errors. When we're talking about truly nonlinear equations, we cannot say a priori, once I'm at the boundary, is this thing going to move to the right or to the left? Because the motion will be dictated by the solution itself, right? That is part of the problem. We see it here. The value of q at any given point will depend on what q is at that point, where the value of the speed of propagation in Einstein's equation is only plus or minus 1, regardless of what the metric is there, right? If I'm not inside the black hole. But then what we're going to do is we're going to do a very kind of a much more simplified treatment of the boundaries, which we're going to say whenever I get close enough to the boundary, I'm going to say I'm not done iterating the equations there. Simply copy. If the value of the function here is this one, just copy it here and there. And we're going to do the same thing here. This one you just copy that way. So it's an extrapolation. You extrapolate the value. And so what that's telling you physically is that you assume you're always going to force that the flux, there is no real flux of energy near the boundaries. And that's perhaps physically the best you can do to avoid evacuating your solution by sending too much energy out of the computational domain, or increasing the energy of your solution by always feeding extra stuff. So you're saying, I have no flux near the boundaries. And so we're always going to be iterating from some ng, which in this case is, say, it's going to be chosen to 3, if I do that example. There's a number of ghost cells. So these are cells that we're not really supposed to be thinking that they are truly representations of the physics, but they are there to deal with the boundaries. So we iterate from nx, from ng, all the way to nx minus ng. So those are the points. So first we need to reconstruct. So we pick a cell, we pick a boundary. So say if this is our point, we have a cell to the right and a cell to the left. I want to reconstruct here, and I want to reconstruct things here. So I reconstruct the cells to the left. I reconstruct the cells to the right. For doing this, remember, we need this mean mode slope, to where we compare what would be the slope between these points and those points. And when I'm sitting here, when I want that one, will be this one to the left and to the right. So we pass the required information for both of them. Then to reconstruct, remember I said I had to evaluate what I had from the right, from the left, take the average, and that's what we're doing here. And then we compute, we ask what is the value of the matrix at that point, what is the eigenvalues, and with that, we can compute the fluxes. And this is what we call the fluxes. And now we know what it is, and we can use that to advance. And let me just go to the next, and where we're beginning to combine all these things. The calc lambda is just to tell us what the eigenvalue is. omega calculates the jump, given the value of the right, given the value of the left, we take the difference, and now we have the jump. And notice there is this routine now, it's update Q. Remember, we ask RMPL to update all the R variables but the variable Q, which is the one we're using through the ROE, so we have to define that here. And this is where we do that. Giving the fluxes to the left and to the right, I mean, off, giving the fluxes at this boundary and at that boundary, we just take this simple step. And this is where we do the whole thing. So let me just walk you through that. Remember, we were going to use this Runge-Kutta or this this two-step iteration. So we first iterate up to the mid-level. So for doing that, we need to compute what the flux is here, what the flux is there. To compute what each of the flux is there, I have to reconstruct from the left and to the right. Once I get the fluxes, I take half a step. Then I use what I just obtained to update and do exactly what I just did, except at this level, and then I take a full step. And this is what is done here. So first, we calculate the fluxes. That goes into that routine that calls all these other things that calls the metrics, the jumps, the eigenvalues, et cetera. We update Q. Notice delta T B2 is delta T divided by 2. That has been defined up there. We update the boundary points because we're iterating only from the third point to the next minus NG points or 3 points. And now we have the values at the mid-level, and then we call exactly the same thing, except that now we are doing it with a full delta T. And then this independent residual is if you want to monitor that what you just obtained is a solution to your equation. So I'll just show you what the independent residual has. So this independent residual just says, OK, just take that equation. I don't even know what you've done. But let's do the simplest possible evaluation of that equation. You tell me you have a good solution. So I'm going to just assume that all this is smooth. So I'm going to take q, t as the derivative between this point and that point. Q squared divided by 2, comma x. I do it with respect to this level and that level, and then evaluate it. Of course, this will fail if we're at across a shock. If we're across a shock, this is a good derivative, as we discussed, as long as we don't have discontinuities. So when you plot this residual, if you have a shock, you're going to have a piece that is giving you garbage. But if you say, well, it would be very unusual that we would have everything well beyond the shocks, and at the shocks, we're doing a problem. And so if everything is fine, except in just some discrete regions of your space, then you don't have to worry that more in trying to evaluate the residual. This will tell you already that you're doing a good job, right? I mean, you could try to put something that is fancier, try to look for the shock, do the mean mod, do the slope limiter, but that would be a lot of work for what you're trying to do. The only thing you're trying to do at this level is assess if you have computed things correctly. So for all intents and purposes, you can just assume that everything is smooth, and when it's not smooth, you're going to get garbage. But if everything else is converging to zero everywhere else, then it would be very unlikely that you actually mess up in your iteration. And, oh, we didn't see this one. But let me just, this is just an example of the reconstruction that we said we would have to do. So we are at a given point. We compute the slope to the left of it, the slope to the right of it. These are these two. With that, we feed it to this mean mod, which is a routine that we have defined, satisfying, I mean, I can show you later, the criteria that if the slopes have different sign, we define this to be zero. If they have the same sign, you always pick the weakest slope. And then you say the reconstructed value of the function, or the variable, from the left or from the right, is given by the value that you have at that point, plus the slope times the difference, the delta between the point you have and the point you're trying to reconstruct. So that's the code. You have it. It's completely written, so you can just get this code and do the very first exercise. But if you want to attempt the ultra-relativistic Burgers equations, the ultra-relativistic, sorry, Hydro equations, notice that there you're going to be dealing with two variables rather than one. You're not interested in that equation. You're interested in the equation for tau and s. So you kind of have to change things. You're going to have to go back. And, okay, very few things need to be changed, but some need to, definitely. So the matrix is a 2x2 matrix, so you need to update this one to have defined four different components. The eigenvalues, now you have two rather than one. And so what you could do is just approach the problem as twice as many equations as you have here, because in that, all that code, except at the very guts of it, where you define what each of the flux is, and everything else is very transparent. It's just totally general. And so you can just say, I have two equations like this, say Q1 and Q2. Equals zero for the appropriate fluxes. So you can just do a completely general thing, but essentially just augmenting the number of variables that you're going to have, Q1 and Q2, for standing for, say, tau and s, and then just do, just by simple modifications of everything you have, then you should be fine. The only quirkiness that we have in this problem that we didn't have in the Burgers is this floor. Nowhere in the Burgers equations is there a floor, or the conservation or the transformation from conservative to primitive. So every time you're updating your variables from here to there, you're updating the conservative variables. You also need the primitive variables, so you're going to have to write a little routine that does a transformation. But that's all you need to add that it's not already contained in there with very simple modifications. So if you actually want to give that a try, start and ask me. And we can get you going if you have any problems. But then perhaps this is also an example of why, RMP is very easy to get you going. There will be cases where you're going to see that, okay, it's not a solution for anything you might want to do. There might be other problems that you might, as well, you could ask RMPL to do the wrapper, so as the memory is dealt with, the output is dealt with, but the guts, you're going to have to go and compute or code yourself. Are there any questions? No? Okay, as I said, just ping me as many times as you want if you actually want to give this problem a try. If not, next week we actually switch gears in a major way. We're going to kind of go away from the Hydro and go back to Einstein's equations and going far in now beginning to discuss things of that you would have to be aware if you're trying to do a numerical simulation of Einstein's equations nowadays. How would you tell, for instance, in your space center that you're constructing, if you're forming a black hole or not? If you're forming a black hole, by definition, a black hole is only known once you have finished the full space-time. But here you want to know of a local notion because you may want to avoid being too close of a black hole or want to react to the fact that now the curvature is going to be going to hell near the vicinity. So we're going to have to discuss things like how do you define a local notion of a horizon, this how an apparent horizon enters, how you're going to find it from your computational domain. And once, how do you integrate Einstein's equations to actually construct the spacetime? And what is it that you have to do once you have the spacetime constructor or along the fly to extract the physical information, in particular gravitational waves? So all this is going to be covered next week. And then new numerical issues that you're going to have to be aware of that will be brought by the fact that now you have a very active, very dynamical curvature, stronger curvature in the system, how numerically you're going to have to react to this issue that you're going to have to face. And just as a last point, this is an excuse. Of course, if you're not dealing with black holes, we're dealing with any other thing that could have a strong curvature, okay, the black hole is an excuse. You're going to have to deal with very much the same problems. How you discretize your problem, how do you add a finer grid locally, because if you add it everywhere, you may run out of computational resources, et cetera. So that will be covered by Franz Pretorius, except one day that I think I'll be the one teaching. But by all means, ask any one of us any questions that you want.